Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. It's the weekend, and it's time to record our full-length episode. We just got done recording our Madness edition. That went quite long. There was a lot of madness this past week. And when it comes from a market standpoint, it looks like we're going to have a bit of market madness this upcoming week. But Brent, we can't not get started without talking about the BRICS and Jackson Hole. So first, let's go after the BRICS. What were your thoughts on the summit?
Well, listen, I mean, where to even start with this one?
This is pretty much the core of the show is just to troll the whole BRICS concept.
Well, and here's the thing. If people would be realistic when they're talking about the BRICS, then it wouldn't be such a big deal. But all year, it's been that the U.S. is in decline. The rest of the world has now decided that they are going to, you know, emancipate themselves from the U.S. empire. They're going to launch this gold-backed currency. And it really is a true this time that, you know, it's the end of dollar hegemony. They're only going to trade amongst themselves, and they're going to use a gold-backed currency to do it. And therefore, this is the year that the dollar starts its decline into, you know, the ether. And listen, this is, I mean, the BRICS are a very big part of the world, and they have very large economies. They have a huge percent of the overall population. The growth rate of their GDP is higher than much of the Western world. So yes, of course you have to pay attention to this. And when they get together, you need to listen to what they're saying and the policies that they're advocating. But what you don't have to do is think that this means that the, you know, the U.S. is going to burn to the ground and they are going to magically rise and take over, you know, the way the world works. And that's why I push back on this so hard, is because people just jump to these ridiculous conclusions, you know, and they will highlight all the bad things in the United States and the corruption and the, you know, the election interference and all this kind of stuff, right? But yet, let's remember who we're talking about here. Right? We're talking about Brazil, who's had a few scandals in their existence. We're talking about Russia, who's, you know, not exactly known for the most libertarian of ideals. We're talking about the Chinese Communist Party, which, you know, again, they still have internment camps for certain portions of the population, and they're not exactly known for, you know, a lack of coercion on their side. And we're talking about South Africa, who, you know, the power goes out almost as much as it goes out in Puerto Rico. So, you know, let's keep it in a little bit of, you know, reality here, you know. And then of course they're adding, you know, apparently they're going to add Saudi Arabia, and that's going to really do it this time, because Saudi Arabia, you know, they never cut people up in the back of, you know, of embassies and carry them out in body bags or anything like that. You know, so they've got clear moral authority. And so it's just, it drives me crazy when people think that the sins of the United States automatically bestows sainthood on the rest of the world, because it isn't like that. And I have no problem with people pointing out the, you know, the negative aspects of the United States and all the mistakes we've made. But then to automatically assume that it means that these other countries who have an enormous amount of problems of their own are just going to automatically be able to do something like, you know, ditch the dollar, even if they chose to do so, it's just not reality. And so what I try to do is push back on this and bring a little bit of sanity to the conversation. And of course, then people think that I'm being mean or I'm being rude. And, you know, that's the life of Brent Johnson.
Yeah, Brent, you got to work on your social skills. So when we started doing this, we made a point that it wasn't going to be the weekly milkshakes show. I think we've been doing a really good job of that. But when you get into something like this BRICS summit, it really does bring out all this lunacy. And I think what you just said was such a great introduction to the topic, because it shows this isn't anything by any means that you're taking personal. Again, it's you're being as agnostic as possible about how the world could potentially unfold. But when you really look at the chess pieces, you got to be more realistic about, you know, the game afoot.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think it's really important to understand both sides of the argument. And so literally when I went to George Gammon's conference earlier this year, I gave a presentation and the first 35 slides of my presentation were why the BRICS were going to dethrone the United States and the dollar. And I went through every bullet point of their advantages and why they shouldn't be taken lightly. But, you know, then when you measure it against the other side of the argument, it's just not quite there. It's one of those things where, you know, and I know we keep coming back to this. I'm probably going to say it every episode if I remember to say it, is investing is not about what you want to happen. Investing is about what's actually going to happen and in increasing the value of your portfolio. Now, if you want to go change the world and you want to make decisions that you think will lead to a better world, then that is totally fine. I think that's very honorable and you have my full support. But that's not the same thing as trying to increase the size of your portfolio. It might be, it can be, but it doesn't necessarily be the same thing. And, you know, where I come at it, both in my job and on this channel, is from an investment standpoint, right? That's what ultimately this show is about. It's about financial markets, where the world is heading, and how to increase your personal wealth and portfolio. And, you know, I have a fiduciary duty to do that for my clients, regardless of where I like things are going or not. So if I were to start investing my clients' portfolio based on my personal moral compass or based on my personal political views, I would be in breach of my fiduciary duty. And I think if people would look at their own portfolios with that same lack of emotion, I think in many ways it would help them. Now, it's great when what you want to see happen aligns with the facts that you think are actually going to happen. But I think it's very important to distinguish between those two. So anyway.
Certainty is something that we try to get people to walk back from the cliff on. Some of the other things we've kind of jingled around with is that the inevitability does not necessarily mean imminent. The, popular vocabulary words that we've pushed or tried to push people away from are things like should and never. As soon as you start putting those words into your investment vocabulary, you find yourself into some trouble. I think you've said before, and I would reiterate that the last couple of years, one of the great things about things, alternatives like, say, Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency markets, is it's educated a whole new population on how the monetary system works. But again, you know, when you take some of those ideas and the potentiality that Bitcoin could do whatever everyone hopes it will do, you're playing that should, and, you know, that inevitable is not as the same thing as imminent type of philosophy, and you can get yourself into trouble. One of the things I've noticed this week when you've talked about the BRICS and kind of been back and forth with people is, and we've talked about this before, but it'd be fun to highlight it here again, is this idea that, you know, now you kind of have this coalition. It's not just the BRICS, it's how many letters do you want to stick into it. And so at any point, they're just going to flick the switch and stop using dollars. And especially the Saudi Arabia thing, it's like, ha ha ha, the petrodollar's over. Not to mention, you know, we're the one providing military defense to them, but that's a whole other conversation. So explain again the pain that would be caused and why these participants in nation states, you know, having the impact of the euro dollar market and the various investments they've made with dollars, why just a flick of the switch is not going to be the end of the dollar without significant pain.
Yeah, and the way it's very important to kind of understand this. And the way I'll set this up is I'll reference a tweet that I sent out. So yesterday, after the BRICS meeting was over, I sent out a tweet that highlighted the most important sentence from the official communique of the meeting. And it, you know, and there was a sentence in there that said, you know, we are going to work together to explore the possibility of no longer using the dollars for trade amongst members. And we're going to set up facilities to, you know, encourage the trading in local currencies, you know, and that's very negative for the dollar, obviously. And then I said, no, just kidding. That's from 2010. And that sentence that I highlighted is literally a sentence I pulled out of the official communique at the end of the BRICS meeting in 2010. So they've been talking about this for a long time. And again, you know, a week or so ago, I put out a little picture of Lucy holding the football, you know, and I called this the BRICS-backed gold currency. And Charlie Brown is the U.S. dollar fatalist. You know, he's really going to kick the field goal this time. And then every year, you know, they pull that back and say, well, we're not actually doing it. And here's why they're not actually doing it. First of all, no country, I don't care what country it is, certainly not the United States, certainly no country in the West, and especially not Russia, China, Saudi. Nobody wants to, no government wants to give up control of their currency. Now, they might eventually have to do it, but nobody wants to do it. China already has a managed currency that they manage themselves. You think that Xi Jinping, one of the greatest strongmen of the last 100 years, wants to give up control of his currency when it's one of the biggest levers that he has? Do you think Putin, you know, arguably one of the biggest strongmen of the last 100 years and has been running Russia for the last 25 years, you think he wants to give up control of his currency, which is one of the biggest tools that he has? No country wants to do this. It's Saudi Arabia. You think they want to give up control of their currency? Their currency is pegged to the dollar so that it provides them stability. You think they want to give up control? No, they don't want to. And that's the first reason why it is very unlikely that they go to a gold-backed currency. Okay. Now, I'm not saying it can never happen, but it's just, it's not preferable, right? Okay, so then the other thing is the idea that, you know, they just stop using the dollar and there's no ramifications for them and there would only be ramifications for the United States, again, is completely wrong. You've probably heard this concept or this quote over the last several years, you can't taper a Ponzi, right? Once you start pyramiding debt on top of debt, you can't really taper it because it's a system that has to grow in order to not crash. And so that's often attributed to the United States because, you know, we've run these budget deficits and we've taken all this debt and we can never pay it back. 100% true. You cannot taper a Ponzi, and that's why the U.S. economy and the way the U.S. monetary system is designed has to keep growing and why it will probably eventually lead to either the inflation of the currency or a crash of the system, right? Okay, let's take that as a given. That also applies to the rest of the world because they use the euro dollar market. And the euro dollar market is even more leveraged and an even bigger Ponzi scheme than the United States. And that system, the money in that system is not owed to the United States. It's owed to themselves. So it's Turkey owing it to France, or it's the Philippines owing it to Japan, or it's Russia owing it to, you know, China or whoever it is. And so if they just stop using those and they get rid of all their US dollar liabilities, then they are also getting rid of all their euro dollar assets. And euro dollar assets are a huge part of the assets of the BRICS and all of the rest of the world's countries. So until they can all agree on exactly what kind of currency they're going to use, who's going to build it, who's going to implement it, and who's going to enforce it, it's all kind of a pipe dream. Now, I'm not saying that this can't eventually happen. It can, and it probably will, but it will be a tremendous amount of pain to do it. And there just hasn't been nearly enough pain. And for the BRICS to stop using the dollar, get rid of their biggest customer, and all of a sudden implement this system that also destroys their own assets, it's just really, really hard to do. If they could do it without the pain, they would have done it 15 years ago. And so just think about that. You know, it's one thing to say that I'm going to get up every morning, I'm going to run 5 miles, I'm going to come home, I'm going to work out 2 times a day, and I'm going to be Mr. Olympia, right? It's not easy to do. It's one thing to say it, it's really, really hard to implement it. And even if you do implement it, you kind of have to have the genes of Arnold Schwarzenegger to pull it off, right? And so, you know, there's one thing is desire, another is the ability. And, you know, it's just, it's really, really hard. And so that's kind of why I push back on this. And, you know, I try to do it a little sarcastic. I try to kind of be funny. I try to, you know, throw up these, you know, different analogies to kind of simplify it and make people understand. And, you know, I think I've gotten through to some people and I think it's helpful people. Obviously, some people think it's me being mean or me being, an asshole or whatever it is. But I think it's because when you try to use a little bit of logic and reason and a little bit of tempered emotion when discussing these topics, people who feel very strongly about it in an opposite way and in an emotional way, it's kind of like Trump derangement syndrome. They just can't have it, you know. And the last thing I'll say is, when I was in St. Bart's last week and I was talking with Jeff and George and Hugh and all these guys, and we're talking about the system, is we are not advocates for the system. I think we would probably argue against the system more strongly than anybody, because we have done so much work to understand how it works. And we know the inefficiencies. We know the problems. We know how it's going to lead to even bigger problems and probably lead to disaster. So we're not advocates for this system, but we are acknowledging the, not permanency, but the institutionalized effect of the system and how hard it is to overthrow. I mean, when you think about revolutions, you can probably name the top 10 revolutions in history, because there's probably only been 10 successful ones, right? Can anybody name the 1,000 revolutions that didn't succeed? No, because they're in the dustbin of history, right? And the reason they're in the dustbin of history is because it's really, really, really hard to pull off.
So the dollar milkshake theory, something that we have defined in a playlist that says start here on our YouTube channel. It's one of your original presentations. It's still quite good, maybe not quite as refined and colorful as they've become, but there's also a few other videos associated with that that discuss the euro dollar markets. But one other thing I want to put an exclamation on what you just said that comes from the dollar milkshake theory is you're talking about tapering a Ponzi, and you know, people have also kind of made the comment, well, they'll just stop paying those debts, or they'll default on US dollar debts. Well, that doesn't happen without creating immense pain, destroying their own asset values and other types of ways. But at the same time, and just to be clear, when we're seeing the argument around government deficits, specifically in the US, and how that leads to weaker dollars and, you know, paper money just is getting inflated away, you often make sure people have that grounded understanding. This is, number one, a relative game, but that's actually keeping the system running. As the dollar is weak, or, you know, trending weaker over time, especially in the global markets, it's really just keeping the whole Ponzi going. It's not until something like a decision, as rogue as it would be, to completely give up on US dollar assets and US dollar debt, that you would start to see a default in those types of things and the demand for dollars increasing, which would make the dollar painfully stronger, which is really your whole point about what leads to the eventual collapse.
No, that's absolutely right. I think myself and many of the people who, I guess, disagree with my thesis, we all end up at the same destination. I just think it's a much different path to get there. And to those who say, well, why don't you just prepare for the end game and just hold on? That's fine. If you want to do that, that's fine. But again, you know, I have a fiduciary duty to manage assets, and you know, not everybody wants to just sit there and hold on and experience the pain of holding on while we eventually get to that destination. And in fact, I think there's a great opportunity to increase your wealth on the path to that destination. And it's very possible that if you don't have some kind of assets other than, you know, gold or Bitcoin or whatever it is that you think that does well in the end game, if you might get liquidated along the way, or you might end up being a distressed seller rather than somebody who benefits. And so I think that's a big part of it. It's one thing, you know, to understand where paradise is at, but, you know, to get through the gates to get there is pretty difficult. And I don't think everybody's going to be successful.
Well, gates of paradise this week were apparently in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. For you, they were in St. Bart's, but for the, you know, the sociopaths of central banks around the world, they found their way into Jackson Hole. What were your thoughts on some of the conversations or sound bites that came out of that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I didn't follow it as closely as I typically do, just because I was out of town and then I was busy. Of course, I listened to Jay Powell's speech, you know, I thought he came out and he was hawkish. He wasn't as hawkish as last year. You know, one of my favorite tweets of the whole year last year was there's a picture of Jay Powell and a couple of the central bankers, you know, standing at this, you know, next to this fence looking out at the mountains. And I remember this guy, he said, this is a live picture of Powell taking a piss on my portfolio. And the reason he said it is last year at Jackson Hole. So in July of last year, 2022, after the Fed meeting, the market took his comments as very dovish, and markets ramped for the next 3 weeks into the Jackson Hole conference. And so last year he came out with guns blazing, hawkishness, and just basically said, you guys are idiots. You didn't listen to a word I said, and rates are going a lot higher. And of course, assets, you know, portfolios just sold off extremely hard on that. I thought yesterday, I thought he was hawkish, and I thought he reiterated that, you know, we're not in a big hurry. We're not done hiking, and we're not in a big hurry to, you know, start cutting rates anytime soon. And we're going to keep restrictions, you know, tight for a very long time. And the market, but he didn't really say anything new. That's basically the same thing he said in July. And the market was initially up, and then it was down, then it finished up a little bit. So I think the market is still trying to call his bluff here. And I still don't think that they believe him. Based on what I saw yesterday, I think that a hike is, unless there is a major market dislocation between now and the end of September and the next Fed meeting, I expect them to hike. The best quote that I thought that there was at the very end, he said, we are navigating by the stars under cloudy skies. Now, on the one hand, there's actually a couple hidden meanings in here, or at least one hidden meaning, and I didn't pick up on it. Mike Green tweeted something out about it, and then that's where I was like, oh. Anyway, but it kind of shows that they don't really know what they're doing, right? They are trying to figure it out. They think that they need to keep tightening in order to get the inflation back down to their committed level of 2%. And they don't have these precise scalpels, right? They have kind of hammers and chisels, and those can do work, but they can also do damage. But they're going to continue to use them because they think they're the smartest guys in the room, and they think they know what they're doing, even though they, you know, even though they don't know what they're doing, and even though they don't necessarily have the right tools. But the other thing that that was referring to, apparently it was a jab at the former governor of the Bank of New York, Fed governor of the Bank of New York, who came up with this R-star concept, and that we need to use that as our decision-making tool. And so, and apparently Powell has a little bit of a rivalry with him, or doesn't see eye to eye with him. And perhaps he was dissenting from, you know, the continued tightness. And so, you know, navigating under the stars was apparently a reference to the R-star, you know, statistic. And don't even try to ask me to explain R-star because I can't do it. But, you know, it's just another one of these concepts that, you know, some, you know, room full of 100 PhDs came up with to tell them what to do with interest rates. But, you know, Jackson Hole is kind of like the Super Bowl for central bankers. It's where they all go and they meet, and, you know, it's kind of like their summer camp. So, you know, we had our summer camp in St. Bart's, and they had their summer camp in Jackson Hole. So, you know, like I said, John, I think next year you and I need to go there and report live.
It seems very feasible at this point. Thinking about these central bankers, or at least these PhDs sitting in a room coming up with some other type of random model that doesn't really work. It got me thinking about, you know, if only they were in the arena with us. So, you know, you mentioned hawkish and dovish. We did a midweek update last week. The title of that video is When Doves Cry. So if you want to have a better understanding of what those terms mean, you can go and look at that. Saturday morning, just recently, we posted our Madness edition for the week. We covered a ton of things. You were just in St. Bart's for this Monetary Madness conference with Hugh and some friends. There is a link in that Madness video for some of the conversations that you had there. So people should definitely go and check that out. And you do talk about how there's just a big lack of understanding overall for how the system works and some of the policies and procedures that, you know, that they're trying to implement to tackle a problem they don't fully understand. There was a meme this week that I thought was pretty funny. It used a reference to the show Friends. And I think it was Chandler talking to Joey, and I'm not a real big fan of the show, but Joey was kind of like the dumb idiot in the group. And he's saying like higher, and Joey repeats higher. And he's like, for longer. And then Joey repeats for longer. And they go through this whole back and forth thing. And he's like, holding rates higher for longer. And then Joey replies, rate cuts coming soon. So it does feel like the market just doesn't want to listen to the message. And as long as Powell can kind of keep getting away with these little inch higher or moving rates higher inch by inch, it feels like he's going to keep trying to do so.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, he was, to me yesterday, his comments were about what I was expecting. I thought he would come out hawkish, but I didn't think he would come out guns blazing like last year. And that's kind of what he did. You know, I felt he was very consistent. He was very firm, but he wasn't like overly pounding the table, you know, hawkishness. And I think the reason is because, you know, as we've discussed on the show a few times, I think he can kind of start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe he thinks he can actually pull off the soft landing, and so that's what he's now trying to manage to. But I do think the people who are long risk assets without a fear because they believe that the rate cuts are coming and they're going to go back to stimulus, and so you want to buy assets that are going to go up a lot when QE comes roaring back, I don't think that's the right tack to take here. I mean, I've said this before, is I think the easy money for the year has been made. I expect the rest of the year to be pretty difficult. Doesn't mean we're going to have a crash, but you know, we're getting into the kind of the fall, and interesting things always happen in September and October.
Well, we do a Monday peak of the week, and this week is, there's quite a bit on the calendar, so everyone should tune in for that in about a day to see what's kind of headed our way. But as you mentioned, you know, you can dissect, and everyone's going to have a different perspective on Powell's tone overall. But what would you take the overall market reaction? And not just this past week, it seems like there's a lot of, you know, you took a short position. You were net short for some time. And is that starting, are you getting more confident about that? Looks like retail numbers are starting to pull back. And then, of course, you know, give us your thoughts on the craziness with NVIDIA.
Yeah, so markets now are below, either at or below where they were kind of in mid to late June when I took a short position via puts, and I added more last week because, you know, when they bounced, you know, last week, in this show last week, I said my guess was that we would bounce in the early part of the week and volatility would show up in this latter half of the week. And that's kind of what happened. It wasn't crazy volatile, but, you know, when markets bounced into Wednesday, I added a few more puts just because I think it's prudent. And you know, for what was that, 6 weeks from, you know, I guess mid-June until beginning of August, you know, I even said on here, I think I was stealing FOMO because markets traded up another 3 or 4% from where, you know, I had entered the short position. But that everything that I followed was screaming to me that this was the time not to jump into the market. And I said, everybody's gonna capitulate their jump in, and that's when the 2x4 is gonna come out and hit an upside the head. That's kind of happened. We haven't had this monster sell-off, but equities have now pulled back to their kind of the mid to late June levels. And I think it's going to be really hard to get the momentum to break out to the upside. I don't see a strong catalyst to break through that previous high level from a month ago or 3 weeks ago. Again, doesn't mean it can't happen. It's just I can't see it right now. And I think there's a number of headwinds that will continue to kind of you know, push the market lower. Now, I've said before, I don't know that we're going to have a crash this year, and that's not my base case. My base case is we get some kind of a correction and you probably buy it, but we'll just have to wait and see what that is and when it develops.
So the momentum piece is, I think, important thing to highlight, because the trend shift for some of these names is pretty real. You have Nike, Foot Locker, Disney. Some of these, I think Nike in particular, it's 9 or 10 consecutive days down. That hasn't happened in, you know, a decade or whatever the number is. Once you start getting into that kind of negative feedback loop, we've had such a positive feedback loop for so long, those trends can be just as difficult to break out. Now, you know, the darling of what's left of the bull market has been anything tech, especially anything AI. So NVIDIA, after crushing expectations and earnings and then doing another ridiculous set of guidance, is one of those things. I wonder if this is the new paradigm, or are they going to be the top indicator? Because when you look at the rest of some of these other major players, they're, you know, the multiple of NVIDIA is in many cases three times. When you look at the rest of the S&P, in some cases, I think it's like 15 times. So has this thing gotten out of hand?
In my mind, it's gotten a little bit out of hand. And I have to say, like, NVIDIA could not have had a better quarter. They had an amazing quarter. Quarterly earnings. They announced earnings on Wednesday night. And so let me back up. A couple weeks ago, you know, kind of into the beginning of August, NVIDIA ran up, you know, after the Fed meeting, up to kind of the high 400s, call it 480 level, right? And then, you know, it pulled back to like the 410 level over the following couple of weeks. So it hit that thing, it pulled back, and now post earnings, it jumped back to, it traded over 500, in the overnight session after releasing earnings. But then it closed down on Thursday, and then it closed down on Friday. So if they cannot break out from that high on the quarter they just had, I don't see how they can have another quarter that's even better than this one. Now, again, this doesn't mean that they're going to stop doing great. It's just going to be hard to beat expectations after the quarter they just had and having guided higher, right? Now, again, it's not impossible. It's, you know, it may be wearing this new paradigm, but valuations do start to become important. And so what I would encourage everybody to do, and I sent a tweet about this last night, whenever these thoughts pop into my head financially, I typically will tweet them out. But, you know, I actually believe that it is a little bit of a new paradigm. I actually believe that technology investments are going to go much higher in the years ahead. But that doesn't mean there's not going to be a pullback first, right? And this is a time where I think we're going to get a pullback before it just rockets higher. And if you look at the chart, if you look at a chart of NVIDIA, it went up, it pulled back, it kind of went up and retested those levels again, and now it's pulled back. You know, really, really good chartists will tell you when you start making, you know, when you start hitting your head on these higher levels and then start rolling over, even on good news, that's kind of the time to short. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. What I would encourage people to do, if they really want to be in on the trend, they think this is a real company that's really going places, but are a little bit worried about the valuation, go back and look up a guy named Scott McNeely. So Scott McNeely was the founder, one of the founders and the CEO of a company called Sun Microsystems. And Sun Microsystems was an internet darling kind of in the mid to late 90s. And in 2002, kind of after the dot-com bubble had burst and Sun Microsystems was now on its, you know, descent rather than ascent, he gave an interview to Business Week magazine. I don't even know if Business Week magazine is still around, but he did this interview with Business Week. And I'm going to paraphrase here, and I'm not going to get it right, but I encourage everybody to go look this up and read it, because it's one of the best form of communications regarding the ridiculousness of valuations and how hard it is for companies to live up to these valuations. He basically said, you know, for me to have justified the valuation that investors were ascribing to Sun Microsystems, I would have had to return all of my earnings to all of the investors every year for 10 years. I would have had to do that while also getting my cost of goods sold down to zero. I would have had to not pay any taxes over that time period. And he said, all of those things, any one of those things is extremely, if not impossible to do, but you guys wanted me to do all of them. And so again, that think about that with NVIDIA. I'm not sitting here saying NVIDIA is not on the forefront of the next revolution, because I kind of think they are, but that doesn't mean that the valuation is currently justified. Maybe it is, you know, do your own homework, come to your own conclusion. I'm just saying when you look at its valuation compared to everybody else, and then if you start to think that it is time for that stock to take a breather, and you consider that it has been the darling of the year, the best performer of the year, it's now it's probably one of, if not the largest holding in a number of different either growth or technology related indexes. And then you consider the effect of passive has on these indexes. And if you consider that it now starts to go down, the effect that just NVIDIA going down could have on overall indexes, it's not insignificant. So again, that's just another reason why we're at a very interesting inflection point here coming into September. You know, I think that the odds are that we have more volatility, not less volatility.
Brent Johnson with the sobering take after a week of drunken hype and headlines. So I'm going to tease everyone up here. We have an idea for a new segment, WWJD, What Would Johnson Do? Since we've had covered so much ground in this episode, we're going to save that. I think everyone should stay tuned for in the midweek update. I have a good question for our friend Brent here. But I really appreciate all the insight. We started off kind of recapping a little bit of the Dollar Milkshake by shining some, again, grounded thoughts and light on this BRICS conversation. We talked a little bit Jackson Hole. We looked at some of the impacts of that had on the equity market. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll be doing a Monday peak of the week because all of this is going to roll into a pretty busy and data-filled week ahead. So, Brent, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. And you and I will be joining the Milkshake fam here in a little bit. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.